Welcome to Modern Church History. I'm Teresa Holman, and I'm here with Father Michael Witt. Welcome, Father.
Thank you, Teresa. Good to be back.
It's good to be here on show number 32, and we're talking about the missions this week. And
that's right, yeah.
All the explorers and what they were and weren't capable of doing.
Yeah, this is one of those stories. It's a story that's not often told. I had to do a little digging in order to find some of this information. Once again, I just really recommend anything Warren Carroll writes. But there were a number of others that I had to dig some information out in order to find these poor guys. They're just very not very well known. And I think probably because they didn't have great success. They didn't baptize hundreds of thousands. They didn't convert whole nations. They gave their lives attempting to do that, attempting to spread the gospel. And in some ways, maybe we can learn from that perseverance.
Okay.
There was a wonderful quote that Mother Teresa always had, you know, that our job is not to succeed. Our job is to have faith.
Right.
And boy, that's exactly what these men were doing, these men and women were doing. This is the 17th and 18th century, the 1600s and the 1700s, a time really which was dominated in church history back over in France, where you have so many of the great saints, Vincent de Paul that we've talked about, and Louis de Montfort, Jean-Baptiste de La Salle, there's so many of these others, and so they tend to be like the sun. They dominate the sky, and we don't see some of the other stars.
Mm-hmm.
But there is incredible stuff going on, and patterns that are developing that are important, and part of this is due to the vision of one of the popes. So it's Pope Gregory the 15th. It's interesting that I think that as we look back, perhaps in the 22nd or 23rd century, look back over the last 500, 600, 700 years, that these two popes, Gregory the 15th and then Gregory the 16th, are going to stand out as being the two popes that really spread the gospel all over the world, that truly globalized the Catholic effort of evangelization. And so Gregory the 15th sets up in 1622 a congregation within the Vatican known as the Sacred Congregation for the Propagation of the Faith.
Mm-hmm.
And this becomes a real engine to propagate the faith. It really does. And he puts in charge a very energetic cardinal. It's a Cardinal Francisco Ingoli. He is not only very energetic and very foresighted, but he also has a very long tenure in this job as leading up the propagation of the faith. He's in that position for 27 years.
Wow.
That's a good long time.
That's a long time.
You know, under any corporation, that would be a long time, but certainly in the church, that's a very long time. What he does is he tries to gather as much information. He uses the congregation of the propagation of the faith to gather as much information as he can about what's going on in throughout the world. And he does this independently of the governments of Spain and Portugal. So much effort had been done prior to that. Remember that under Charles V, even before that, Ferdinand and Isabella, that they were really given the responsibility and the authority to spread the gospel, to evangelize by, first of all, Pope Alexander VI and many others following after that. But here we find that those two monarchies have become lax. They're no longer the driving Catholic forces that they had been before. And so Cardinal Ingoli uses the propagation of the faith in order to sort of do an end run around them. He's going to concentrate on new dioceses. He's going to concentrate on secular clergy, the diocesan priests. That's going to be his real thrust. This is in the 1600s. There's going to be the real thrust there. One of the other things he's going to do, too, is build on the idea of the vicars apostolic, because the kings of Portugal and Spain have the right to name bishops.
That's right.
they're naming their own cronies, and they're, you know, they're not really doing what they need to do for the good of the church, and certainly not for the good of the people in the mission territories. And so by adding another sort of a layer of apostolic leadership, this directly connected to the Vatican, then there is a better sense of taking the initiative, that the Vatican can take the initiative. Another thing that's done also at the same time is the establishment, Pope Gregory establishes a special seminary in 1663 known as the Société de Mission Étrangère, the Society for Foreign Missions.
Okay.
And the idea there is to develop a whole cadre of diocesan clergy, secular clergy, working in local communities. The one objective to all of this is going to be to bring about an indigenous clergy.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see some success in some areas in that, particularly in China. China will actually have a bishop in the 1600s, a Chinese bishop. And so you can see that all of this that Cardinal Ingoli is doing is a canonical end run around what had been called the Patronato Real, remember the royal patronage, and so by emphasizing the power of the vicar's apostolic, you know.
That must have been an interesting seminary to have then I guess. Seminarians from around the world.
Well,
what's
actually,
the goal, I guess?
You're going to have mainly European seminarians who are going to be studying with the intention of
going out.
Yeah, leaving France and never seeing France again.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
Italy, never seeing home again.
Okay.
And they're being prepared. We're also going to see, especially in the Far East, an island, a Christian island, which is going to be really the last preparation, a language school, really, for these seminarians. Or, I'm sorry, for these missionaries, when they go into the countries. Many of them spoke the language of the people by the time they arrived.
Oh, I would think that would have been critical.
Absolutely, absolutely. When we look at and see what went on in Ireland. By the Anglican Church, with the intention of the attempt to convert the Irish to Protestantism, the biggest problem they had was their clergy coming over to Ireland not knowing Gaelic or Irish, and obviously got nowhere as a result. So the language is very, very important. Now, what I'd like to do is I'd like to look at a couple areas. First of all, India, China, Vietnam, Sub-Saharan Africa, both in the West and the East, and then finally end up with a little look at Paraguay.
Okay.
These are all areas that there was tremendous mission activity, not always successful, but maybe we can learn from the failures
right.
as well. In Italy, or sorry, in India. There's an individual who really stands out. He's a Jesuit by the name of Roberto Nobili. Arrives in Goa, in the west part of India. This is a Portuguese dominated colony. Okay, and travels along the Fisher Coast and learns Tamil. The language of the people,
okay,
which is different from what the Portuguese Catholics had been doing. Basically, Goa was a transported Portugal, you know, and they expected the people of India to learn Portuguese in order to be evangelized. There was a priest there at the time, Father Fernandez, who certainly exemplified the Portuguese approach, and Father Nobili had practically nothing to do with Father Fernandez. They met, they disagreed immediately, and so Father Nobili then went off and into the interior, and not only learned the language, he also learned how to read Sanskrit. which is the sacred classical language, so that he could read the classical Indian literature. He studied Brahmin customs, even to the point of giving up leather shoes, you know, because the leather, of course, is coming from
the cows.
The cows, mm-hmm. Yeah. he studied, as I say, the literature of India. It's one of the great ancient civilizations. Studied the philosophy, and himself became known as a spiritual master. Interestingly enough, one of the reasons why some of the Indians were taken with him was that while he spoke the language and understood the literature and all, he also used a scholastic methodology. And so he was sort of bringing together mm-hmm. both the East and the West, and it was quite enthralling. Ultimately, he baptized 10 young men who became his followers. How much they actually understood what they were doing is up in question. Historians wonder about that. But nonetheless, he's able to attract 10 young men in a style that would be similar to others, other spiritual masters in India.
Well, that recalls to mind for me the picture of Our Lady of Guadalupe on the tilma, how much it incorporated for the natives.
Yeah, good point.
Of what they knew and why, yeah. Just by looking at that picture, that they were able to convert.
Yeah.
Maybe somewhat of the similar format, I guess, for them, and that he was able to incorporate what they knew and to use.
That's a really good point, because and this is one of the great tensions of this century and of this effort, is because there are going to be those within the church who are going to resist this,
right?
Saying that we've got to, you know, they're having a hard time distinguishing between big T tradition mm-hmm. and little T traditions mm-hmm. and customs and mores. And so are not able to develop that way. But like exactly what you said, you know, the tilma teaches the people
right.
in a way that
they already understood.
Yeah. I thought about the early church. You know, if in the first century, if we had simply said, we're Jewish roots, we're a Jewish cult, and tough, you got to learn Hebrew and Aramaic if you're going to be a Christian. Well, I don't think we would have converted many Greeks. Certainly St. Paul's ministry would have been a disaster. Mm-hmm. Instead, of course, he converted the whole eastern part of the Mediterranean. But what if we had stopped at that point and said, okay, we're going to be Greek from now on, and you got to learn Greek? You know, of course, that didn't happen, especially in Rome. We adjusted to that, so much so that today the only piece of that ancient time when we were predominantly Greek is the Kyrie at Mass.
Right.
You know, the same thing is true a couple centuries later when it became the effort of the church was to convert the Germanic tribes, the barbarians. Well, if we turned around and said, well, you've got to be Romanized first before you can, you know, be converted to Christianity, well, that wouldn't have been very successful either. So every time, all along throughout church history, the church has always adopted to the culture, bringing the unadulterated message of Jesus Christ.
Right.
And that's the key, is to know what the message is. Mm-hmm. And that cannot be watered down, and then the other particulars, the accidents of culture, which are up for grabs. And in some cases, it does become a big issue. Both in India and in China, there are some real solid theological questions as to what's going on. We'll take a look at those.
Okay.
But certainly on the surface, it doesn't make any sense to say, well, you have to learn my language for me to evangelize you.
Right.
You know? And so Father Nobly, as I say, is at first successful with these 10 young men. He is known as a spiritual leader or master in India. Eventually, he will convert some 63 members. That's still a pretty small group. But here's where he runs into the big problem. And the problem he runs into is the question of converting these members, these Indians, into Christianity. And yet at the same time, they would not or could not give up their caste status.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that there's a very mm-hmm. tight caste system, a hierarchy in India. And how do you deal with that? You know, it's one thing for St. Paul to say that there is neither Greek nor Jew, slave nor free, man nor woman, but whether the people of India would be willing to accept that is another question. You know, he had some real difficulties with that. He had some real difficulties with his own Thomistic background, as St. Thomas understood society. And as he looked at India, India did not fit that pattern at all.
Right.
How do you challenge that? You know, and at the same time convert? That's a real problem. In the end, what he tried to do, and he was unsuccessful in this, what he tried to do was a two-prong mission. One prong going toward the upper class, the Brahmin class.
Mm-hmm.
By 1620, there were 178 members. By 1643, toward the end of his life, he had some 600 members who had converted to Christianity but had not given up their caste prejudice yet. Then he also had another mission that was for the lower classes. But that's not good Christianity, is it?
Right.
You know,
right.
And St. Paul had something to say to the Corinthians about them doing the very same thing. But this is what he was left with, and eventually, as I say, he died. There is another Portuguese Jesuit who comes in after him in the late 1600s and tries to take up the work and is not at all successful. His name is John de Brito, and Father de Brito was, first of all, in 1686, was arrested and then tortured.
Mm.
He was sent off packing. This is in 1686. In 1693, 7 years later, he came back again.
Oh, my gosh.
Isn't that something? It reminds us a bit of our own experience with St. Isaac Jogues.
Right.
You know, and some of those early martyrs mm-hmm. That we had here in North America. He actually returns.
Wow.
And he was beheaded. At that point, that really ends the efforts to Christianize India, and I guess what you could say is that maybe our evangelization has to be done in multiple prongs in multiple ways, because as much as these Jesuits failed to convert India, which would have been absolutely phenomenal when you consider the size and the population. On the other hand, I wouldn't criticize the Portuguese approach all that terribly much. Yeah, it's true that they sat in Goa and didn't do much, but on the other hand, they also lasted for centuries.
Right, right.
Know. So maybe we need a multiple approach to this evangelization. Probably the best known of the era, although he actually lives a little bit earlier than some of the others, is Father Matteo Ricci, the Jesuit.
Mm-hmm.
When he was 30 years old, he left Europe and made his way to toward China, and got as far as the island of Macau. This Macau is this incredible language school. And that's where he learned Chinese.
Okay.
He just stayed in that area for a while and learned Chinese. And in 1583, made his way to China itself.
Okay.
Landing on the coast and moving into the capital. Obviously, he was quite a spectacle for the Chinese. He was even introduced right to the emperor himself.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the emperor, Wan Li. One of the reasons why he was so well received was that he brought some gifts. Now, there's so much that the Chinese have given to the West, gunpowder being some of the more notorious, but also the compass and printing and a number of other things. He sort of returns the compliment, and he brings a number of gifts to the emperor. And the one gift probably that was the most important of all was a clock.
Oh, okay.
And the reason for this was, that was so important, was that he gives the clock to the emperor. The emperor is taken with this clock and just, you know, for days on end is just enthralled. And then it stopped.
Oh, no.
And, of course, you know, being very proud, they wouldn't call Matteo Ricci and ask him
how does it start.
So he gathered together all the experts at the court, and they studied the clock. And they couldn't figure out how to make it work again. And then finally they had to give up, and they asked Father Ricci to come in, and he showed them how to wind the clock. This impressed the emperor.
Okay. You know?
Another thing that he brought with him, too, and that he wasn't alone, he had some other Jesuits, too, was tremendous skills at map-making.
Oh,
this is a time when map-making is becoming so important, and exact map-making. Mm-hmm. And so he gives over to the Chinese this ability, and once again, just was very, very impressed. Here we have another issue that comes up. It's a philosophical issue. Now, we'd seen before with Father Nobili, the issue was of a caste system in Indian society. In China, the issue or the problem is going to be with a Chinese word or concept. The word is Tian Chu, and it means the Lord of Heaven.
Okay.
It's a deity.
Oh, okay.
But is it a personal deity? Is this God a personal God?
Uh-huh.
Is this God the God of Jesus Christ? Is this the God of the Old Testament? It's not real clear. And so there's a lot of argument that goes back and forth, not between the Chinese and the Jesuits, but between the Jesuits and the Jesuits, or the Jesuits and the Franciscans over this concept. Matteo Ricci is one of those also who has adopted the dress of the Mandarins. That's easy enough because there is no habit. The Jesuits don't have a habit, so they could wear anything they want, and so they do filling into this in society. They, of course, speak the language, speak Mandarin Chinese, but this is the one sticking point that's not real clear. They've even also translated the Mass into Chinese. By the time Matteo Ricci died, he died in 1610. It's pretty early.
Pretty early.
He has some 2,000 converts.
Wow.
And many of them at the royal court. So here we have, again, one of these end-run attempts to do a Pepin. If you remember back in early church history with the Franks in the early Middle Ages, you have the conversion of the king of the Franks. And then with that, within one generation, the entire, what becomes the Holy Roman Empire, Germans and French, are all converted.
Mm-hmm.
So there are two ways of approaching this. One is the down-up, and the other is the up-down.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And they were really trying for the
up-down.
Yeah, up-down. In 1644, however, the Ming Dynasty falls.
Yes. Okay.
And so any attempt at that point to convert up-down pretty much fails, with one exception. There's one little string hanging on. The Jesuits were able to stay and have a presence at the court only with one member. And he was a German fellow by the name of Johann Schall von Bell. And Father von Bell had an ability that the Chinese respected and needed, and that was the understanding of the calendar.
Oh, okay.
We take it for granted. I mean, our idea is, you know, we just go ahead and go down to the local stationery store and buy a calendar for next year.
Right.
And we just assume it's correct. But that's not necessarily the case. And there are from time to time adjustments that have to be made.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Teresa, on this, the Feast of St. Teresa, we might remember that it was in 1515 that Pope Gregory, the same Gregory, no, this would be a different Gregory, I'm sorry, that Pope Gregory adjusted the calendar.
That's right.
And remember that there was a 10-day jump from October 5th to October 15th. And, of course, that's the day that St. Teresa of Avila was born, this being her feast day. So it's just a reminder for us that calendaring is not an exact science necessarily. And here's a man who understood it better than most understood. And so that they had great respect for him. He continued on living at the court. However, ultimately, in 1664, the remaining priests in China, there were 38 of them, were expelled.
Mm-hmm.
These are the 38 foreign priests. There were by now five indigenous Chinese priests.
Oh, okay.
And this is only a little tiny fledgling beginning, but there it is, you know.
There is something, right?
Yeah. They were all executed.
Oh,
all five
all
of
the
Chinese
five were,
priests
okay.
were executed. Yeah. Mm. It took three more years for another emperor to come in. And this is a young man. He's a boy. He's 14 years old. And the Emperor Kang Qi, he invites the Jesuits back. You know, after
okay.
this terrible experience, he invites them back. And what his real interest is in astronomy and in Western sciences.
Oh,
and
mm-hmm.
these guys know their stuff. And so they're invited back in 1667. They are able to continue the work of Father Riki, converting people. Once again, they speak Chinese. They dress in the Mandarin style. They use Chinese philosophical categories and names, Confucian names, and the Mass is offered in Chinese. One of the great high watermarks comes in 1692 when the emperor promulgated an edict of toleration in which he recognized Catholicism in
mm-hmm.
China.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're playing for some really big stakes here.
Right.
You know, the most populated country in the world, even then. Not only this, but also there is now more Chinese priests again and also a Chinese bishop. And he himself, his name is Lo Wen Tao, and he was converted in 1633 through the efforts of the Franciscans, and eventually would serve some 7 years in China from 1685 to 1692, I think, something like that. But unfortunately, after him, there would be no more Chinese bishops until the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What undoes all this effort is the visit by a cardinal with a very closed mind.
Uh-oh, okay.
Yeah. His name is Cardinal Charles de Toron. And he visits the East in 1701, sets out, leaves Europe as a special legate to the Pope. And his intention, his mission is for fact-finding.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but when he arrives in India, first thing he does is and it takes him 2 years to get there. It's 1703 by the time he gets there. He goes through and immediately condemns the work of Father Nobly. Now, maybe it should have been condemned, especially since Father Nobly was not able to grapple successfully with the question of the caste system.
Right.
But the whole approach was thrown out. It was the Portuguese approach that was preferred. And, of course, the Portuguese approach was going nowhere in
uh-huh.
evangelization. He arrives in Beijing in 1705. So, and he arrives at a place where there is great Catholicism. It's growing. You know, in the court, among the people, indigenous clergy, they have just had a bishop, Chinese bishop, who has just died not too many years earlier, still a fond memory. He arrives at the court of the emperor and presents his credentials to the emperor
okay.
in such a way as to tell the emperor of China that he is a legate, he is a representative of a great monarch on equal standing with the emperor. He probably could have gotten by without mentioning that.
Mm-hmm.
But it was an insult to the emperor. Of course, the Chinese have this sense of being the center of the universe, the center of the world, and you know they are the Middle Kingdom and all that. And so the first thing the emperor did was he expelled them.
Mm-hmm.
Kicked them out of China, and so then sitting outside of China, then the cardinal then gives command that all of the stuff that Matteo Ricci and all the Jesuits had been doing must be reversed. Mass must be celebrated in Latin. You have to use Roman-style vestments. You have to wear cassocks. You can't be running around looking like a Mandarin. Latin is the language of the church. Use Latin, not Chinese, and the whole works, and everything just begins collapsing. He himself died in Macau in 1710. Unfortunately, the damage was done, although his replacement was a very kind man. His name was Cardinal Meza Barba. And he attempted to reverse all of this, to moderate this, to ameliorate the problems. And he pretty much sets things up until 1742, when Pope Benedict XIV issued a bull, in which he demanded Roman practices in China, and ultimately Catholicism died in China for all practical purposes and would remain, or at least in a comatose state, for another 200 years. It was the one great moment of in which there was almost this great Christian conversion in mm-hmm. China didn't take place, and we would have to wait another 200 years. In the 20th century, I just want to real fast mention that in the 20th century, again, Christianity began to grow, late 19th, early 20th century. It, of course, is again stomped down by the Communist Revolution of the late 1940s and maintains itself there in abeyance up until today. But as we'll see toward the end of our presentations, that the church is very much alive and well in China. There are literally millions of Christians in China today. And some of them belong to the government Catholic Church, and mm-hmm. others belong to an underground Catholic Church that is loyal to the Holy Father. But there are millions, and it's still it is the big prize. Yeah. Well, that's the story on China.
Okay.
We go on then to take a look at Vietnam.
Oh, yes.
And here, again, there is a heroic personality. His name is, he's a priest. His name is Alexander de Rhodes. He's actually from the Diocese of Avignon.
Oh, really?
You can't get away from that place. his intention was to go to China, to Japan.
Okay.
He was going to be a missionary to Japan. He was going to follow in the steps. I don't know that he belongs to an order, but he wanted to follow in the footsteps of Francis Xavier. However, in 1591, when he arrives in the area, it turns out that Japan is closed.
Mm-hmm.
It's a closed society. He cannot get in. So he goes to Macau instead.
Okay.
And he is going to start learning language, and mm-hmm. somebody said, well, why don't you learn Vietnamese? And so he did.
Okay.
And he learns Vietnamese. He goes to Vietnam. He'll be there for 2 years. From 1623 to 1625. So he has spent a good portion of his life on Macau.
Okay.
And uh-huh. just trying to get into Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
In 1625, he's kicked out.
Okay.
So there he goes. In 1627, 2 years later, he comes back again.
Okay.
This time he goes to northern Vietnam.
Okay, we learned what happened to the last person that got
yes.
kicked out and went back. So,
and this time around, the Vietnamese seem to be a little bit better.
A little more tolerant.
A little more tolerant, okay. Because in 1630 they kicked him out again.
Oh, okay.
But in that amount of time, in those 3 years that he worked in the northern part of Vietnam, he converted 6,700 people.
That was successful.
Now that's successful.
Okay, wow.
He then spends the next 10 years of his life on Macau, okay, waiting for the Vietnamese to forget about him so he can slip back in again. In 1640, he does. Now, the capital of Vietnam at the time was Hue.
Okay.
It's the ancient capital.
Uh-huh.
Okay. It's in the center between north and south. And he makes his way to Hue, where he continues working. In 1645, he is again banished, kicked out of Vietnam, this time for life. And he took it seriously.
Oh, he did. Okay.
Yes, he did. He returned to Europe, 54 years old.
Okay.
And spent the remainder of his life in Europe teaching seminarians to become...
What to do when they go back?
How to get kicked out politely.
How to get kicked out of Vietnam without getting your head taken off.
One of the things he did, which was very, very important, was he began a new approach at evangelization. Now, the approach that the propagation of the faith had taken was, and it was a good approach, was to use vicar apostolics,
mm-hmm,
vicar's apostolic, and then to begin building the indigenous population of clergy. What he did was, recognizing that he was not going to be able to get a lot of this kind of effort in, he began what he called a company of catechists.
Oh.
These were going to be lay brothers, okay, religious brothers, who vowed celibacy, who lived in community, who lived under a rule, and they would be indigenous. So what he did was he took his own converts, and he took some of the men who were on fire with a vocation themselves, and he brought them into this community of brothers. Now this way, they were not going to have to go through the long training in philosophy and mm-hmm theology and seminary work in order to prepare themselves. He realized that he didn't need that. That would be like sending a battleship into a little pond.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, don't need that. But you do need little boats, mm-hmm, and these guys would be the little boats that would get into the rural areas. And he trained them in the basic catechism of the Catholic Church, and then also had them trained in medicine.
Oh, smart.
Wasn't that a good
mm-hmm
idea? Yeah. And with that, using the medicine as a hook, then mm-hmm he would evangelize. So that's what we call nowadays pre-evangelization.
Mm-hmm.
You do the pre-evangelization and then evangelize after that. Pope Gregory the 16th ultimately does the same thing in the 19th century. That's why we have all of these medical these hospitals, medical centers, schools, orphanages, all these all throughout the world that are set up in the 1900s,
mm-hmm,
you know, 1800s and 1900s. They're pre-evangelizing, and then afterwards, the evangelization takes place. Well, this is what he will do to spread the gospel in Vietnam. And after working in Vietnam, his total, I think, numbers were something like 13 years. He was there some 13 years. By the time he was finally kicked out, okay, there were 300,000 converts in Vietnam.
300,000. That was a major success.
Yes, it certainly was. No clergy,
mm-hmm,
with the exception of two priests. There were two priests for 300,000. That's quite a lot.
That appears to be a problem.
And they were also hunted down by the government.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to, they were on the run.
Right.
Okay. But also, one of the other things, a little aside, is that Father De Rhodes is the reason why, if you look at the Vietnamese language, it doesn't look nearly as foreboding as Chinese,
right,
or Japanese or whatever. In fact, it uses the Roman alphabet,
mm-hmm,
with lots of little distinctions,
mm-hmm,
markings. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
But he's the one who's responsible for introducing the Roman alphabet to China.
Really?
Or to Vietnam.
To Vietnam. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And once again, we'll find that that these roots that are placed in Vietnam are going to be dormant for many, many years. There's going to be great persecution of Christians in Vietnam. But Vietnam is one of the great Catholic centers in the 20th century. And even with the communist overthrow of South Vietnam in the 1970s, they have not succeeded in rooting out Catholicism. Catholicism mm-hmm. is alive and well. And certainly we experience that here in the United States with Vietnamese Catholics, Vietnamese Americans, many, many vocations coming yes. from that community.
Yes. Yeah. We have a very active population here in St. Louis.
St. Louis, that's mm-hmm. right. Yeah. Well, let's take a look at Africa.
Okay.
And there we're looking at first of all, the West Coast, and then we'll take a look at the East Coast. One of the earliest examples of this is going to be from the Portuguese. As the Portuguese are working around, remember, this is very early on, and as they're working their way along the West African coast, they're going to come in contact with a number of African nations. In one case, the king of Portugal and the king of an area along the Congo area, I guess maybe closer to Nigeria, will actually exchange young men from each other's courts. Four young men will be sent from Lisbon to what is now Nigeria, and four men from Nigeria sent to Lisbon, Portugal, and they'll spend years at each other's courts in order to learn the language and the law, and they then become the translators in building a relationship. One of the kings will eventually convert, but it won't go any further than that, at least not until actually a little bit later on, further south in Angola in 1656, a princess Nachinga of Matamba will convert to Catholicism and convert several members of the royal family with her. There we're looking once again at the Pepin solution, mm-hmm, you know. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, at the time of her death, it went no further than that. So it's going to be off and on again, really based upon the ruler's intentions, whether they're welcoming or not, mm-hmm. the health of the missionaries, because this is a very difficult part of the world for Europeans to survive. Quite honestly, between the disease and the heat and everything else, they just don't do well.
Okay.
A couple years ago, I had a seminarian do some research on the coming of Christianity permanently to Nigeria, which is, again, a very important up-and-coming Christian and Muslim country in the 21st century. And what he found was that it was actually not until in the 1840s with an expedition, I believe it was in 1844, an Anglican expedition went to what is now Nigeria and began the permanent evangelization of that region. And it was done by Nigerians who had left Nigeria and were converted to Christianity in other parts of the world and then returned to their own lands because they had the stamina in order to bring Christianity to Nigeria. So in many ways, there's a little adage among Nigerian Christians that Nigeria was converted to Christianity by Nigerians, mm-hmm. As opposed to almost everybody else, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of truth to that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so there are those attempts, but in the West, it's not in the 1600s and 1700s, you won't have much success in West Africa.
Okay.
Yeah, for those same reasons. Also, there is no particular individual figure that stands out. There's no Father Nobly or mm-hmm. Father Ricci or Father DeRose.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. On the east side of the continent, there's some developments that are taking place also. On the continent itself, you've got Mozambique, mm-hmm. which is a country that's just north and east of South Africa. And there, Dominicans and Augustinians have long been involved, but they tend to hover on the coastline.
Okay.
Okay, they're not going to go into the interior, and they're basically servicing other Christian communities, Christians in the area. It's the Jesuits who, when they arrive, go, hey, let's go on inside.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I would do that myself. I have a friend who came back a year or so ago from not too far away from that area on a safari. I mean, it was a real safari. Uh-huh. And the stories he had about poisonous snakes, lions and tigers and bears, oh my, and giant spiders. They had webs so big that they caught birds.
Oh, my gosh.
There ain't no way.
No, that's not for me.
But handed to the Jesuits, they
that's
did.
Right.
And they went right into that interior and did some evangelizing. What ultimately is going to be the undoing of Christianity in that area, and as a result not having much go on, is that in 1628, a king in that region is going to rise up against the Christian community in a surprise attack. He'll kill the Portuguese ambassador, and then war will take place between the Portuguese and the king of what is now Mozambique. The Portuguese have the military technology. They win.
Mm-hmm.
They install a new king who is both pro-Portuguese and pro-Christian, but he's a puppet. And so nothing really, really sticks. It's going to be another century or two, well, another two centuries before Christianity has a chance to get a toehold again in Mozambique.
Okay.
Actually, a little bit further north, what becomes Uganda and Kenya and Tanzania are going to be richly evangelized. But that's going to come out of North Africa, interestingly enough, by a French bishop. Yeah, but we'll see that later on. Off the coast of East Africa is the very large island of Madagascar. And that also is going to be an area of interest. Particularly the French are going to send missionaries. In 1642, the Congregation of the Mission is going to arrive. The Vincentians are going to arrive. They themselves will put in an effort some 32 years long of evangelizing, and in the end, the native population will rise up against the Christians and slaughter everybody, a good number, and everybody else fled. So again, Madagascar is not going to be fertile grounds for evangelization for another century and a half or so. Well, we have time for one more disaster?
Well, we do. We do.
Okay.
I guess we do.
But these are noble disasters.
That's right. That's right. But we can look back now and know that there are converts to this day. I know from my college days, we had some students from Madagascar at Benedictine College. So
there was
some promise there.
Well, not only that, but also if you remember the Vatican ambassador to Madagascar, many, many years ago when he was a young man, was none other than Monsignor Regali.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
He's got a connection to Madagascar.
Oh, you know, I think I did just see that not too long ago in the review, maybe.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there we've got another connection there.
Right.
Well, Latin America.
Okay.
Okay. We've had a problem there for a long time, partially because the Patronato Real. Again, the bishops are being named by the kings of Portugal, the kings of Spain. They will only name Spanish and Portuguese bishops. They will not name anyone who is actually native.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's their Creole or mulatto or Indian, there's not a chance. They won't even ordain them to the clergy. So it's just a difficult situation. There you have a huge Catholic community with very few shepherds, and shepherds again that are not attuned to the flock, because they're coming from Spain or Portugal. You know, well, the Jesuits attempt to do an end run around this also, and the area that they're going to choose to do that is in Central Latin America, and they establish what is today Paraguay and Argentina. Okay, that area around there. They'll establish a government around 1600. They come across a group of Indians called the Guaraín, There's a movie called The Mission, you might remember.
Yeah.
Yeah. This deals with this same period of time. It is not entirely accurate.
Okay. As movies go.
Yeah, as movies go. Let me put it this way. The spirit of the film is correct. The facts are not.
Okay.
But don't let the facts get in the way of a good story. what the Jesuits did try to do was... the Guarani were a very wonderful group of people, isolated from all the other stuff going on in the world, and so they began working with them, establishing Christian villages and converting the people, which they were quite successful at. In 1610, one village, the village of Loreto, was established, and over the next 13 years, some 23 other Christian villages were established in this jungle area, leading to the conversion of many of the people who move into these villages. Now, ultimately, these villages will grow to 100,000 people.
Wow.
Not all of them will be converted, but a good number of them are converted. They have lots of trouble from colonial colonists in the area, both Portuguese and Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
There are going to be constant conflicts with these, and mainly there are going to be conflicts between them, the Guarani, and the Portuguese Indian or native Creoles.
Okay.
That is to say, those Portuguese who have married in with the native populations and now the next generation or so.
Mm-hmm.
They're close enough and yet far enough away to have some difficulties. Whether or not slavery has anything to do with it or not is another question. The whole premise of the film, The Mission, is that the Jesuits go in, set up what is basically paradise on earth, and the slave runners of the Portuguese go into the territories and harvest slaves. They capture people and take them away. I don't know exactly how true that was, but there were definitely difficulties between the two. We also, in the film itself, shows how the Portuguese are in cahoots with the Spanish, who do not have slavery. The Portuguese do have slavery, but they're in cahoots one with the other, and eventually they'll invade this Republic of the Guarani and kill the people in the town of Loreto. The fact of the matter is that in 1641, the King of Spain had forbidden all colonists to enter the area of the Guarani. Whether the Portuguese or not would follow that is another question. He also permitted the arming of the native populations to defend themselves against the colonists. So you have some examples there of that. The Jesuits do a lot to promote education in this area. They take on the Guarani language, develop literature. That's when they discovered the incredible ability of these people in music.
Yeah.
They had wonderful hand-eye coordination and wonderful small motor skill, so that they were able to produce instruments of the highest quality, and then with that also being able to play them, it comes out in the music of the film, The Mission, and in the story that they were a very a gentle, beautiful musical people, and it's true. They sang Gregorian chant just as good as anybody anywhere.
Uh-huh.
You know, and so all that's going very nicely. There are problems, however, with the Jesuits, with this particular republic, and part of the problems was, and maybe it has to do with just the physical size. These Jesuits tend to be relatively tall, big guys, the Guarin were little. Mm-hmm. They were just little. And so they were treated more often than not as children and not taken seriously enough. While they were given education and music and literature, they were not trusted really to run their own government or given the other responsibilities. There was no attempt at recruiting native clergy. Hmm. That was just simply beyond the mindset of the Jesuits, that there would possibly be vocations among these people. They did not set up any order of nuns. They didn't set up any company of catechists. Remember, like Father de Rhodes did in Vietnam. There is no political development. And so in 1773, when the Jesuits were disbanded, the whole experiment just collapsed.
Right.
When they left, everything just collapsed. Ultimately, the people themselves would go back into the jungles. The jungles will overtake the villages and the fields and the plantations, and not much of anything comes of it. In the movie itself, the abandonment of the civilization for the jungle takes place in a very dramatic scene in which everyone is killed in Loreto except for a few children, little children who survive, who then take off all their clothes and get into these dugout canoes and go back into the wild. You know, that's not the story. It didn't happen quite that way. But one, you know, get the idea.
Right.
Well, what's the bottom line behind all of this? You know, it's a whole century, two centuries of beautiful attempts.
That's right.
You know, and along with that, also recognition that it's going to take another couple centuries for communication and transportation, in other words, just technology, to catch up with the vision that the church had for its world mission.
Right.
You know, ultimately, steamships are going to be a lot faster and a lot more efficient to bring missionaries to their centers, and then also fighting disease and those sorts of things is going to be so important. Another thing to keep in mind is that this effort teaches us again, and we've got to be very careful of this. I think we are today. I think we really learned this lesson as a church. Catholicism in most of those countries was perceived as a foreign Western
idea,
influence,
concept.
Or
okay.
concept. Yeah, mm-hmm. Celibacy was not understood.
Mm-hmm.
The Latin liturgy was not well received. And so it really becomes a question for the Christian missionaries to step back, look at and analyze the failures of the 1600s and 1700s and see what can we accommodate and what can we not. How can we enculturalize Christianity without losing the truths of what we're teaching, what we're bringing? How do we become, like St. Paul said, all things to all people?
Mm-hmm.
And yet still bring the message of Jesus Christ. I think that's the real lesson behind these failed attempts in the church. I think that as we look at the 19th and 20th centuries, we're going to see that the church learned that lesson very well.
Good.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we often learn more from our failures, right, than our successes.
Well, that's true, isn't it? Yeah.
So, all right. Well, Father, great show. Can we close with a prayer?
Sure. Okay. Glory be to the Father, to the Son, to the Holy Spirit, as it was in the beginning,
is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen.